Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sasha Paulson, features editor for the Napa Valley Register, and I'm delighted to be here to lead a conversation this evening with Violet Gergich about her father's autobiography, A Glass Full of Miracles. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Violet.
Thank you so much, Sasha.
Well, you know, the Napa Valley is filled with fabulous stories. As a journalist, I can tell you we find them everywhere, but there is not one that can match the story of Milenko Mike Gergich, who began his life in Croatia in a tiny peasant village, who survived Nazis and fascists and communists and made his way to California with this dream of making wine and maybe one day owning a winery of his own. He accomplished this, and along the way, he changed the wine world forever. And Violet is his only child, his daughter who grew up alongside him as he was working and working and working towards this dream, once he finally made it to California, of every day being better, of every day learning something new, and of just constantly working for this dream. She is a Napa native who grew up working with him and learning from him, and like many people from Napa, went off to UC Davis, but there she studied music and went on to earn her master's degree from Indiana University. And then, as many of us who left Napa did, came back. And decided it was a pretty good place to live. So Violet today is vice president for sales and marketing at the winery that her dad founded, along with Austin Hills. And in addition to being an accomplished musician and a mother of an 11-year-old son, she is stepping into her dad's shoes to carry on the tradition of one of the most popular and finest and most famous wineries in the Napa Valley. In addition to everything else she was doing in the past year, she's helped Mike finish his autobiography. At the age of 90, he decided, with encouragement from Violet, that it was time to tell his story. And so that's how A Glass Full of Miracles came into being. And so I guess the first question really, Violet, is why did you want your dad to tell his story?
Well, I guess I've always thought he's had an amazing story. I grew up listening to him talk about his life growing up in a very small, very poor peasant village, about escaping death, escaping from communism. Same thing with my mother. They both grew up during the war in Croatia, which was part of Yugoslavia at the time. And I never met anybody in America who had stories like this. It was just so amazing to me. And it always felt so real that I think to this day I've gained an appreciation for the things that I have, my safety, my stuff, my house, my car, my family. I don't walk into my house without thinking I might not have this. My father didn't have this. My mother didn't have this. So I think hearing those stories made a huge impact on me as a kid. I was also a huge reader and a huge fan of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House on the Prairie stories, and I read those over and over again, and I was so smitten with the characters and the fact that here was a way of life that was preserved in literature in such a way that both kids and grown-ups could enjoy and appreciate and hopefully really appreciate the things that they had in this present day. So in my mind, even though my father was a famous winemaker and helped make Napa Valley famous and made the 73 Chardonnay that won the Paris tasting, for my dad, it was about, I made these amazing wines and I can tell the story of how I made them. But for me, it was about, I need to hear those stories about how you as a human being overcame poverty, war, distress, internment camp, all kinds of things, to be able to continue to persevere with hope and joy and to actually succeed. And to me, that humanistic story was something that I felt was so much greater than the story of wine. So I kept bugging him year after year. And, you know, of course, dads never listen to their daughters because they have not very good ideas. And so finally, at some point, he's like, oh, I don't know, it might be a good, oh, I'm too old, though, it's so much work. And, oh, I don't have the right person to be able to write the book. And, oh, that's, I need to be really comfortable with them. And, you know, he'd met with a few people and he felt somewhat comfortable. But I think when he finally met Sasha, he's like, I think she can do it. Aha. And so they started the process. And my 90-year-old dad managed to finish it in less than a year, I think.
He did.
Yeah.
The first time I met Mike is when I also grew up in the Napa Valley and came back to work at the local newspaper. And as wine editor, one of the first people I met was Mike Gergich. And I went up to talk to him about wine. And instead, we spent over an hour talking about miracles, because he said to me, there have been miracles in my life. And that just was the beginning of a friendship. And I had to agree with Violet that these were stories that he needed to tell, because it was beyond the experience of most of us living a comfortable life. I was astonished to hear about how he had escaped. He had been at the point of being shot by the Italian fascists occupying his village, to the point where he said, I was wondering, how will I know when I'm dead? And then he wasn't shot, and he went on, and he would get an idea, and he would just go on, and he would learn from everybody. All these stories were so fabulous. So I was really honored when he said, would you like to help me tell a story? And he did say, I'm too old, I'm 90 years old, I'm very tired. And then he would talk for hours. And I was just mesmerized, writing as fast as I could. But, you know, when you think about your dad, do you think it was miracles, or do you think it was just this extraordinary determination to achieve a dream? Or is that a miracle?
I think that is a miracle. He learned the definition of luck from an actor, I think, when he first came to America. And that definition is, when preparation meets opportunity, that is luck. And I think that the same goes for miracles. But I think he's actually talking about real miracles, too. Mm-hmm. Not just the fact that, you know, he persevered and he had the will. He wouldn't have done any of it without him personally. But there were some miracles there as well. You know, being a Catholic, well, Croatians are Catholic, so that goes without saying. But there are visions that he's had of a religious nature that I think that's how it started. But the real miracle is the fact that his humanity was so strong, and with such perseverance and never giving up and always setting a goal and following through. So I think that's the real lesson here.
I think so. I mean, he told me that his father, who was a very poor peasant in this village of Desne, but nonetheless a winemaker, told him that when he was 10 years old and Mike had to leave home to go to school so they can continue his education, he said, my father told me, I have nothing to give you except some advice, and that's every day do something better.
Every day do your best.
Do your best.
Learn something new and make a friend.
Make a friend. Make a friend in every village, because that way you'll always have some place to sleep. He told me that one time.
It's very practical.
Very practical. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he just persevered against such extraordinary odds. What are some of your favorite stories about your dad?
Oh, my gosh. I grew up listening to his stories. One of his favorites is when he got his first job at the age of 5. His sister had him babysit his baby cousin, who was, you know, less than a year old. So he's 5 years old. And she said, now just, you know, don't do anything. Just rock his cradle until I get back. Okay. He's like, okay. And so he's rocking and rocking, and he's looking around and above, and all of a sudden the cradle felt really light. He looked down, no Philip. That was the name of the baby. He looks on the floor, there's Philip crying, but fortunately okay. So he scooped him up, put him back in the crib, and started rocking again. Never told his sister because he was afraid he was going to lose his job. So.
But the amazing thing is he was 5 years old.
Yeah.
At 10 years old, he became a shopkeeper in Desna after he'd finished his schooling. So here he is, a 10-year-old, running the first little grocery store in Desna, selling everything,
Selling everything, you know, absolutely. It was like, you know, a general store in Little House on the Prairie. You sold cloth, you sold, produce, you sold nails.
Mm-hmm. And then he went on to one of the benefits of living in a communist country was he was able to go to school. And he went to Zagreb. He decided first he trained to be a bookkeeper. And then he said, you know, I felt that at the end of my life, what would I have? I would have boxes of papers of all these different files. And so I decided to return to the work that my father had done. But he wanted to bring the science into it too. So he went to Zagreb and enrolled in the university and lived there under communist oppression, which just made him decide he wanted to be free. And so he has a story, which he recounts in the book, about saving American dollars and hiding them in his shoe. And then this dramatic escape when he went to Germany, crossed the border and got himself to Germany. And that was really one of my favorite stories, too, mm-hmm. is that how he had that $22 hidden in his shoe. And with that, he was going to get to America and make wine and have a winery. And gosh, he did it.
He did it. Although he didn't, he went to America in a rather circuitous way. He spent almost 2 years in Germany waiting for a visa for America, and it wasn't coming. At some point, he decided he was going to give up, at least for a while, and apply for political asylum. So he went to apply, along with 12 million other refugees, and was put into an internment camp in Nuremberg. And he was there. He was despairing. He thought, this is it. I'm going to die here. I'm never going to get out. And the family that he was staying with, the Franks, they got a little worried when he didn't come back. So they actually went to Frankfurt and found him and got him out of the camp, after which he kept working, kept trying to get his visa. But the way he got to America was he had the opportunity to go to Canada. The Canadians were looking for lumberjacks to go to the Yukon. So they're like, if you want to be a lumberjack, we're going to give you your visa. You can leave tomorrow. So he's like, all right, I'll get a lot closer to America. So he arrived and took a long train tracks across. And I guess when he showed up, the train was late. And the guy who was supposed to meet him to take him to the Yukon never showed up. So he got a job as a dishwasher instead. And after a few years in Canada, finally made his way to Napa. So a lot of history there.
And then he managed to work with some of the really great people of the Napa Valley, who at the time were just determined to really reawaken the wine industry, which had pretty much been shut down by Prohibition. 100 years earlier, there had been a thriving wine industry, and in the 1950s, it was basically ghost wineries with just a few left here and there. And then after the war, people began coming back with this idea of, maybe we can make wine again. Mm-hmm. So tell us about some of the people he met that were so instrumental.
So many people. He talked about, Robert Mondavi a lot. His first mentor there was Lee Stewart, who's a vintner that most people have not heard of, except that he also was a mentor to Warren Winiarski from Stag's Leap, who made the red wine that won the Paris tasting of 1976. So he learned a lot from Lee. And he also then worked with Brother Timothy at Christian Brothers. He worked with Andrei Chelichev at Beaulieu Vineyards, and then finally at Robert Mondavi in the late 60s. And he had this attitude. When he came, when he left Croatia, he brought the things that were most important to him. He brought that $32 that was sewn into the sole of his shoe, and he brought a cardboard suitcase, which is now the Smithsonian Museum, actually, the Smithsonian Institute, full of textbooks. So for him, he felt that if he had education, he could do anything. He was working in paper mill as quality control, and all the guys for their break used to go and play bocce ball. And my dad would sit there and read his textbooks, and they would make fun of him and say, "Wow, why aren't you playing bocce ball with us?" And he said, "You know, my goal is to come to Napa Valley and get a job in a winery. And if I forget some of these things, I might not be able to get a good job. So I'm making sure that I don't forget the things that I learned." And that was very much part of his not, I guess, miracles, but real determination to succeed.
He said that one of the reasons he wanted to write the book was not just to write about wine, but to write a story that would tell, have a message for anyone who read it, which I thought was very touching. Do you want to expand on what his real message to people is?
I think that real message is really in that phrase that he was told by his father, to every day do your best, learn something new, and make a friend. He sort of summed it up in the last few years. I think in his late 80s, he's decided to take a little bit of time off and go down to the warm Southern California in Palm Springs. And he would go down and he would go to a account that didn't have our wine and try to sell them wine. And for the first time in his life, they didn't buy it. He's like, "That's impossible. I always sell wine. I never leave without an order." And he became really depressed. And finally he said, "You know what? I'm going to think that every day I'm going to have one victory, and I'm going to work on that, and I'm going to figure out what that is by the end of the day, and I'm going to do it." So once he started doing that, he suddenly started succeeding again. And he said, "You know, most days I will make it. Some days I'll fail, but I won't take that as a failure. I'm going to take that as something to spur on another victory."
You know, that's so funny, because not long ago, I was having lunch with him up in Calistoga. We were at Soul Bar restaurant, and he summoned the sommelier over to the table, and he said, "There's no Gergich wines on your wine list."
Uh-oh.
And before that lunch was over, that sommelier had bought wine from Mike. He had
no choice.
So here he is, just really absolutely extraordinary, 93 years old, and he said, "Oh, I've done something good today." But it seemed that one of the things he told me was about, as a boy, just finding a book. He grew up in a village. He tried to emphasize, we had no newspapers, no radio, no television. We told our stories, and that's how we passed on our wisdom. But at one point, he did find a book, which I believe was the one about somebody an American who was saying you could accomplish anything you wanted to do. And this is the message, too, that he wants to pass on to people. You may not want to be a winemaker who owns your winery in Napa Valley, but whatever your dream is, he just wants to share with people that idea that you can do it, but you just have to be very, very dogged about it. Mm-hmm. But to get to you, Violet, so I have seen in Napa Valley that there was this whole wave of people who came there in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and they started wineries, and they really revived the wine industry again, and they worked extremely hard, and today Napa has its place in the wine world. But a lot of the second generation is kind of saying, "You know, I've seen how hard my parents had to work. I'll just sell the winery and move on." But you decided to stick with your father's winery. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about why?
Sort of a long story, but as you mentioned, I went off to school and I studied music. And I'd literally grown up in the vineyards. My father would take me to whatever winery he was working at. I was 2 or 3 years old, I think, when he took me to Robert Mondavi. His office was in the tower. So if you guys know that iconic image with the tower with the little iron, that's where his office was. Actually, there's some really good stories in the book about that. But I always thought, oh my gosh, it's like being in a fairy tale. It's, you know, like Rapunzel being at the top. I just thought that was so romantic. And then at Chateau Montelena, he would go every weekend. I mean, he worked all the time. He came home late. He worked weekends. And I had the great joy of being able to spend time with him on the weekends and learn from him. And he would teach me about vineyards and vines and wine. And of course, I grew up drinking wine because I'm a vintner. That's how he grew up. And, you know, the idea was to educate so that, you know, most Americans don't seem to realize this, but teenagers like to do exactly the opposite of what you tell them. So if you make something forbidden, that's the first thing they're going to do, and they're going to abuse it. But I was educated with a little bit of wine and learned about it and never felt the desire or need to go off and drink a lot. Why would I do that? That's crazy. So now I lost my train of thought. What was I originally starting with?
Well, that's
good. Oh, my life and my life in the vineyard. So that's what happened. So no, I really enjoyed being at the winery. But because my father was such a powerful presence and such a powerful speaker, I think some of you here have heard him speak. Literally, when he spoke, people's jaws dropped. People would just, it was amazing to see. And I grew up as a horrendously painfully shy kid. And to see my dad do this and know that I might have to someday do this thing, I'm like, I can't possibly do that. I can barely play the piano in front of an audience without my hand shaking and my feet shaking like crazy. So, but I worked in the winery, 1977. I've actually worked there since the day it was founded. And I kept saying, oh, I don't know, I'm going to go off, I'm going to play my music. But I kept coming back and going back and forth. And you know, finally, I realized that I really loved what I did. And, you know, my dad kept telling me to be a winemaker, that I will be a winemaker. And I think I just had that stubborn streak. But I realized that given my background, my education, what I loved, I just loved being in the business. And eventually, I learned how to speak in public. It was not a fun process. It took many years. But it was I was very mad at my dad because he, you know, being an amazing speaker, he often had vintner dinners that would sell out. So I remember very early on at the Wente Brothers restaurant, which is a fabulous restaurant, great chef. He had two sold out dinners of over 100 people each. And my job was to drive him. And I was so happy I got to drive my dad. I had a wonderful dinner, great wine. Oh, life couldn't be better. And so the second night we pull up to the door and we're going inside and he turns around to me and says, Violet, tonight you're going to talk about the Fumé Blanc. And my stomach dropped into my feet and stayed there. And I couldn't eat a thing. And when I was called up to the podium with the microphone, with the sea of 100 people who'd literally just been going gaga over my dad, saying the most amazing stories in the most amazing way, I was literally trembling like a leaf. And my brain, for the first time in my life, had no words in it. There was no thought. I think I said, Fumé Blanc, nice. Questions? And some gentleman in the audience fortunately thought I was a nitwit and asked me a very difficult technical question, which I knew. So I'm like, oh, thank God, I've got to focus. So I answered that and then sat down and proceeded to say, I'm never going to do this for the rest of my life. So what does my dad do? Violet, next week, you're going to a vintner dinner. Oh my gosh, for years, it was awful. And then finally, I had a very, very awful experience where I was giving a presentation to a group of sommeliers in New York. And I showed up and there was a hostess at the venue. And she sort of looked me really slowly up and down. And she went, you know, they ask really difficult questions. Come on back. I'm like, ah. And So I show up and I'm trembling again. I grab a glass of wine, just sort of like I did earlier, except it was Zinfandel. So I'm swirling I'm not going to do it now because I'm going to spill it, but I'm swirling it around and it shoots out of the glass and it starts in my forehead and it goes in a beautiful curve all the way down my pale cream turtleneck and my pale yellow suit, my pale cream stockings. And I thought, that's it. I'm going to die. Nothing worse can possibly happen. I'm dead. My life is over. And I expected like rotten vegetables to start streaming from these New York sommeliers. And then all of a sudden, I made a joke, and I don't do jokes. And then I put a sentence together. And then it was like, oh my gosh, the worst thing that could ever have happened to me happened. And I survived. And now nobody knows that I'm horribly, painfully shy. Because if I mess up, it doesn't matter. As long as you have the wine, I thought, if I put the wine in front of people and they try it, they'll go, more.
One of Mike's favorite things. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Violet Gergich talk about her father's autobiography, A Glass Full of Miracles. I'm Sasha Paulson. If anybody has any questions, just hand them on in and we'll incorporate them into, oh my gosh, there's a bunch of them. Okay. Okay, Violet, here's a question. What is Milenko's magic? Why do you think that your dad made the wine that won the tasting when there were so many other winemakers that tried their best? What makes him different? I assume we're talking about the Judgment of Paris. Do you want to?
I can. And you know what? I was going to answer that question in a completely different way. And I'm going to answer it two ways. About the magic of wine, I think it's the fact that he'd been around for such a long time. And as my dad will say it, he had so many great teachers who taught him that he learned from them and he absorbed all of their knowledge. So by the time he actually, and before that time, he actually made the 1969 Robert Mondavi Cabernet that put Robert Mondavi on the map. So he was already starting at that time, but he says it all has to do with his ability to absorb knowledge from people and to take that and put it together. And, you know, it's a palate is like music, I think. You have it or you don't. You can teach people to play notes, but you can't give them musicality. It has to be within them somehow. And I think the same thing with a palate and that ability to create that perfect balance between all the components and to do it consistently from year to year. Grapes are going to be different every year. How do you create that consistency of style? That's something that he was able to achieve. And I know the question was about the magic of wine, mm-hmm. but I have to tell another story because the magic of my father is truly remarkable. He always used to complain that he was so short that women would not look at him. And in the village where he grew up, if a man was short, he could only ask a woman shorter than him to dance. So he basically never had anyone to dance with. But I think it is his personality, his determination to succeed that has created such an extraordinarily amazing person. I was told, I met a woman and her daughter who had met my father when her daughter was 6 years old at the winery. And to me, the story tells you everything you need to know about my dad. They came into the tasting room and he said, oh, I have a few minutes. Let me take you around and show you the winery. And the 6-year-old said that the grown-up now, no grown-up had ever spoken to her in the way that my dad spoke to her. He spoke to her not just respectfully, but she felt as if she was the most important person in the world to him at that moment. And he said, whatever you set your mind to do, you can do it. So at the age of 29, I met her. She's crying. Her mother's crying, telling me the story. And she's saying, I'm a really successful architect. And he really inspired me more than anyone else. And I cannot tell you how many stories I have heard from people like that about my dad. When he looks at you, he touches you so deeply that you have no, you cannot escape.
I would have to agree there. There's something about him that he just wants to convey a message that is just so much more than wine, but expressed for him through wine. Let's see, that's the next question. How much about winemaking did Mike learn from his father? How many generations back does the winemaking tradition go?
What a wonderful question. He learned very basic things from his father about winemaking. And I don't know that he's ever gone into the real detail, but I think the sense that I got was that his father had that extraordinary palate and that sense of balance. His father was known for making the best wine in the village, and everyone made what they produced, including wine. Wine actually was a very practical thing to make, because if you drank the water in the village, you would get sick. So some brilliant person, probably a mom, discovered that if you actually mixed the wine with the water, that you could drink it and not get sick. And so that was a staple. You actually had to have wine. And it was that sense of care and attention, I think, that he passed on to him. And that, I don't know, as my dad always says, it's the family genes. He would look at me and say, "You've got my genes. Don't forget that." And I used to get really annoyed, and I'd do the same thing to my son.
This person would like to know more about the partnership between Mike and Austin Hills. How did that partnership begin that led to the formation of the Gergich Hills Winery?
So when my dad was at Chateau Montelena, and especially after the Paris tasting, he had a lot of people come to him and say, "Hey, I think we should form a winery together." And out of all those people, he actually liked Austin Hills the best. It was a younger gentleman. He came from the Hills Brothers Coffee family of San Francisco, so this is his hometown. But he found him to be very thoughtful and with a financial background. And just decided that that would work very well. So after a series of negotiations, he went into the partnership with Austin, as well as Austin's sister, Mary Lee Strebel. So, and it's been an excellent one to this day.
A couple of people have questions about the Napa Valley today. One is... says, "You are a longtime Napa Valley resident. What are your thoughts on how the valley has changed?" And we can go back to one of Mike's stories talking about arriving in St. Helena on the Greyhound bus with his dollars in his shoe and being horrified that it was going to cost him $2 to stay the night at the St. Helena Hotel.
That's a huge amount of money back then.
But so what are your thoughts on how the valley's changed since?
You know, so much has stayed the same and so much has developed. And I think the part that has changed is the fact that because the wine industry is so prevalent, we're still a farming industry. And many people talk about wine and the lifestyle of wine. And I guess because I grew up with my parents, we always thought about wine as an essential part of life, not as a style of life. It was something we had every day. For us, it was something that really was the spirit of the land. And there was that connection with the land and the earth and living things that was very essential for us. So I think many people were often surprised. In Napa Valley, I think there's the feeling that, you know, as my dad says, there are chandeliers in the cellar. Like, the chandeliers shouldn't be in the cellar. We're very proud that ours is plywood and concrete, and we really focus on the quality of the wine and the quality of our people and our hospitality. So Napa Valley has been incredibly famous. We have so many more tourists, and actually only recently have I started seeing now tourists in the actual town of Napa. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And, you know, tourists come, they buy, they contribute to the economy. My dad always likes to say that, oh, it's his fault, so many tourists on the road. But on the other hand, it does make for a vibrant economy and has really increased that idea of Napa as a world... really a global place.
Mm-hmm. Well, in line with that, this person would like to know, what would you say to people who think that the Napa Valley is now overrated and much too commercial?
Well, I would probably say the same thing that people said about the wine train when the wine train first started. Mm-hmm. I think that my father was the only supporter in all of Napa Valley for the wine train. And when they had hearings to allow them in, he went against some very powerful people saying, you know, I grew up taking trains. Why do you consider trains to be Disneyland? They will be bringing people to Napa Valley that will buy our products and go and spread the word about what a wonderful place it is. We were the very first place to actually put a stop for the wine train. We continue our partnership to this day. But I think that idea that the wine train is Disneyland and makes it so commercial is not. It's really an extraordinary experience and allows people to really connect with the land.
Well, this person would like to talk about Croatia. Now, it's an extraordinary thing, but Mike talks about leaving Croatia. He's sneaking out, escaping. And when he left in 1954, was it? There was very little likelihood that he would ever return. I mean, he didn't foresee the end of the communist regime, knew that once he left, he left on a student visa to work in the harvest in Germany, I believe. And then his plan was that he simply wouldn't go back. And that's what he did. But he left his family, his friends, with no idea that he would ever see them again. And it wasn't until, when did he return?
91.
He was actually able to return and then reestablish his ties with Croatia in a very powerful way, founding a winery there. This person would like to know, were there any other Croatian vintners who contacted Mike since? I mean, he's a pretty famous person now in Croatia for what he's accomplished in the wine world and for returning, starting a winery in Croatia, and also doing extraordinary work on helping with the consequences of the war. So do you want to talk a little bit more about his work in Croatia and Croatian winemakers?
So he was actually, when he first came, he met with the president, Franjo Tuđman, who had asked him to help. And my dad said, how can I help? He said, well, do what you do in America, and found a winery. So my dad's idea was to be able to take everything that he had learned since he left Croatia, all that knowledge, all that experience, and put it into a small winery in which would actually be a teaching winery, in which he would invite winemakers, students, to come and learn all the things that he learned. He wanted to teach everybody how to make another 73 Chardonnay. So, but what happened was very interesting, because things had gone during the communist period. There was no focus on quality. That was one of the reasons that my father left, not just because of freedom, personal freedom, but also freedom to really do your best. And so he came in and people were like, what do you mean bringing in barrels? You may as well throw your wine into the Adriatic as put him in a barrel. You're going to ruin your wine that way. So it was really funny. And I would go back year after year and I'd listen to other vintners and restaurateurs and go, oh, Barik, oh, it's awful. I don't know why you do it. And of course, then 1 year after we were yelled at for putting our wine in Barik, the next year I came back and I saw all these Croatian wines saying Barik on them, and they were more expensive than the ones without them. So it's a very much a Mediterranean society in that way. But I think that people have really respected him. He's been a shining star there. Everybody in Croatia knows who my father is. Actually, there was a documentary made several years ago in Croatian. It's called Kao Stara Loza, which means like the old vine. And it's about my dad's life. And that actually airs on Croatian television probably every 6 months. So it's a story that everyone knows, and everyone really considers him to be a national hero.
You know, he talked when we were working on his book about the extreme loneliness he felt when he first came to California. He said here he was, short, lonely, couldn't speak English. He didn't really foresee much happiness for himself. And so this person would like to know, how did he meet your mother? And and what is she like?
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's actually a great story. It's really funny when Sasha finished my dad's manuscript, basically handed it over to me and said, "Don't touch a word. Just publish it and put pictures in it." And I read through it. I'm like, it's missing a little of this. And, you know, so one of the stories was how my dad met my mom. And it was really funny. I heard about it from my mom's sister, maybe only about 10 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. And so there, so my mom's younger sister, Vieka, went to school with my dad's niece.
Your mom is Croatian?
My mom is Croatian, Dalmatian, actually. So okay. Raised in Split. And so one day, Vieka was going to go from Makarska to Desne, which was a really long ways away. She had to take a boat and a train and I think a few other different, and it took a very long time. So she sent her friend Jelica, my dad's niece, a telegram to Desne and said, "I would be there the day after tomorrow. Please come get me." And so she's taking this long trek, and at the very towards the end of the journey, she's on the train, and there's an older gentleman there, older than her, you know, and he starts asking her, "So you're traveling alone? Where are you going?" And she's like, "Nah, who is this guy asking me questions?" So she finally says, "Oh, I'm going to Desna," and so who are you meeting there? "I don't want to say anything." He says, "I'm meeting my friend." He says, "Well, how does she know you're going to meet her?" And he says, "Well, I sent a telegram." He says, "She's not going to be there." And she's like, "What is this person telling this?" Oh. Anyway, so what happens is they finally get to the final stop and her friend's not there. And so the gentleman asks her and says, well, who is your friend?" And he says, "Well, it's Jelica Jeramas." And he says, "Well, that's my niece. You know, she wouldn't get the telegram because I know the guy is really lazy and he only does the telegram every other day." So anyway, that's how the families met somehow. My mother met him at some point. And so he had left her when he came to America and rekindled the friendship after he'd been there for some time and then sent for her, and they got married in 1962. So my mother, if people think my father is charming, oh my gosh, so is my mom. So
yes,
she's pretty amazing.
She's a very spunky woman. And so this is how led to Ivo coming to work at the winery as well from Croatia. And Ivo is now winemaker.
Ivo's now essentially, my father still retains the title, but Ivo is vice president as well, responsible for production, daily winemaking, the vineyards, you name it. So he's the tall one in the family. So his mother, Jelica, is actually my first cousin, which is really funny. I'm his little aunt, and I'm short like my dad, and he's like 6'4". It's really funny.
Very tall. So one of the things that Mike seems to be so proud of, rightly so, especially considering how expensive it is now to farm and in the Napa Valley and to make wine, the joke is, how do you make a small fortune in the wine industry? You start with a large fortune. And but Mike is so proud that it's entirely family owned. You own all your vineyards. He doesn't owe the bank any money. And do you foresee this just continuing to be the pattern for the winery?
Absolutely. It's really the best way to go. I know he always had the philosophy of working hard and saving and not spending at all. But he does remember when he worked at Beaulieu Vineyards with Andrei Chelichev. And actually the owners, the Madame and the Marquis de Pans, were at his wedding and they were dear friends of his. And he remembers them telling their daughter, "If you ever get into trouble, whatever you do, don't sell the land and never go into debt. Whatever you do, that's the worst thing you could possibly do in your life." And she ended up selling at some point, didn't go into debt. And when my dad started the winery, the lawyer who actually introduced my dad in Austin Hills said, "Mike, it's going to be at least 5 years before you make a profit." My dad said, "Nope, I'm going to do it the very first year." And so he did everything, as he says, on the cheap. You know, I mentioned the plywood and the concrete. And so the very first year, he shows up to his lawyer in San Francisco and plops down the financial statement on his desk. And he goes, you're right. I didn't quite make it. I think he missed it by about $5,000. And that was the only year. So that's something that he's been very proud of, very, very proud of.
Well, it looks like we're getting to the point where we have time for just one last question. So I guess what would you say is the most important thing that you've learned from your dad that you would pass on to your own son?
You know, I always encapsulate it into every day, do your best, learn something new, and make a friend. If you do that, you can't go wrong. And I have to say, when my son was 7, he wrote me, my mom had just gotten an iPhone, and so he texted me and he says, "Mama, I believe education is the most important thing in the world. If you work hard and you study and you do the thing that you love, you will make the money that you deserve. I think I'm going to be a scientist." So a year later, he was panicking. "Oh my gosh, Mama, I've got to, you know, I'm going to get my master's in chemistry, and that costs a lot of money. How am I going to support myself? You know, I need to work. I need to make some money." So,
do you think he's going to follow your path into the wine industry too?
At the moment, his thing is, "So, Mama, if I'm an aerospace engineer, can I still work at the winery?" So I said, "Yes, sweetheart. Yes, you can."
Well, this concludes our program. After we finish, Violet will be at the back of the room where there are copies of Mike's book, A Glass Full of Miracles, which she will be signing if you care to buy one and read more of Mike's remarkable stories of a remarkable life. But this concludes the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. The meeting is now adjourned.